Okay, so I thought it'd be worth just very briefly covering a little bit about who we are, because we may not be a name familiar to many of you. We're the world-leading developer of induction loop, hearing loop system products, and that primarily means amplifiers, but also accessories which are used in the installation of these products. A number of measures we take to try and promote our core aim, which is listed at the bottom there, of providing a genuine benefit to the user. Now, that probably doesn't sound like a very ambitious goal, but I think it's worth mentioning that a tremendous number of loop systems don't work as well as we would like them to. And this is not like with sound reinforcement systems in the acoustic sense, that if you go and buy the kind of speakers that DJ Double Dex Dave might use at the local party, they're still going to make some sound. They're still going to do the job. We're talking shades of performance. With this technology, we find a tremendous number of systems simply don't work at all. So when we say we want to provide a genuine benefit, it doesn't sound too ambitious, but actually that is quite an achievement in certain circumstances. Okay, enough about us, a little bit about the subject in general. So at the risk of stealing a little bit of the thunder of tomorrow's session on hearing loss, there's just one slide on this. I thought it was worth talking about the challenges that people who have hearing difficulties face. So here we've got frequency response chart with speech spectrum laid across it. And we're showing a very vague approximation to typical hearing response, somebody with good hearing. Now, you've got to bear in mind that we're typically giving this presentation or these materials to architects, so we have to keep this dumbed down. So apologies if it offends any of the specialists in the room. But what we're trying to illustrate here is that even somebody with good hearing, it's not completely linear. We've got Fletcher-Munson curves to consider and that kind of thing. But somebody with good hearing is able to capture the whole speech spectrum without any significant difficulty. Then we get into age-related hearing loss, and this is a progressive attenuation of the high-frequency sensitivity of somebody's hearing. This is happening to all of us from around the age of 18. It's progressive. It affects some people faster than others. The obvious effect is that over time, intelligibility is significantly compromised. And of course, as Peter was saying yesterday, intelligibility is really the core goal that we're all aiming for, whether we're reinforcing sound acoustically or directly to the hearing aid, as we'll talk about in a minute. So we've got age-related hearing loss. We've also got noise-induced hearing loss. This is somebody's turn their iPod up too much rock and roll, perhaps been involved in heavy industry or perhaps had their hearing damaged via military service or something like that. And damage has occurred in a specific frequency band, usually related to the characteristics of the sound they've been exposed to. So in this case, this person might have pretty good high frequency response, but they've got a big hole in the upper mid-range. And finally, we've got the group who are, if you like, capital D deaf, and that is a technical term. I'm not being flippant when I say capital D. People who essentially have no hearing to speak of. They're conscious of sound via bone conduction, obviously the vibration of your chest and so on you get from standing in front of a big pile of subwoofers. But essentially, there is no conventional hearing as you and I know it. So that's the problem. You eventually, probably a decade or so after you really should have done, admit to yourself you've got a hearing difficulty, you go to the doctor, get a hearing aid, and all's well with the world, right? Well, not quite. There are some real limitations with hearing aids. Now, these are expensive devices, and the manufacturers don't particularly like to shout about some of the problems that users experience with these kind of instruments. But they're quite limited by the nature of the microphones that you can fit into such a small device. Increasingly, hearing aids are in-canal devices, not the over-the-back-of-the-ear things you might think of. And it's very difficult to get the right kind of directivity of the microphone system into such a physically small device. You also have a problem, of course, with distance from talker to listener. They may have heard of digital hearing aids. Essentially, those are they're not receiving noughts and ones from the environment. We're talking about a hearing aid that has a DSP chip built in. And we can do some clever things with that, like, for example, compensating for some of those nasty frequency curves we saw earlier. You can put some EQ into the hearing aid and correct people's hearing to a certain extent. There's also some processing to try and reduce reverberation and in some cases, to also kind of fake do a faking increase in directivity of the microphones, but there's a real limit to what can be achieved. And that's summarized in this figure at the bottom, that one researcher into hearing aid effectiveness found that they're really only optimized at a distance from talk to listener around about 6 feet, which is quite a significant restriction if you're going out to a concert or a theater or to a lecture or something along those lines. Now, picking up on something that Peter mentioned yesterday in his introduction, we're talking about one of the factors influencing intelligibility being signal to noise ratio. This is a piece of research that we've stolen, so do bear with me on this. A young person who doesn't have any kind of age-related hearing loss, who might be considered to have normal hearing, can typically cope with a slightly negative signal-to-noise ratio and still maintain good understanding of speech. An older person who has got, if you like, a mild hearing loss effect, someone you might consider to have a typical hearing for their age, they're needing more of a unity situation. But somebody who has a more pronounced loss is needing a more positive signal-to-noise ratio to maintain that same level of intelligibility. And people with more advanced loss can need 20-plus dB signal-to-noise ratio to achieve the same intelligibility that you or I might be able to achieve. And what's really happening here is the breaking down of the ear-brain machine, a term again Peter used yesterday. There's calibration between those devices, and you get into the cognitive processing of received sound to fill in the blanks, if you like. And if the ear is not receiving sound in the way that it should, that process does not work as effectively as it ought to. And this is where we really need this elevated signal-to-noise ratio that we're talking about here. And to liken that to an intelligibility survey, this is again is a bit of research that we've borrowed for this occasion. Sample size of just under 800. This is people with hearing aids listening to listening in a whole range of environments, some no doubt entirely acoustic, some with reinforcement. And you'll see that the average result is below 50% understanding, and the curve is very heavily biased, you know, towards the upper part of the graph there, where people said they heard nothing. Keep that shape in mind. We're going to revisit that. Another final thing on that, 14% in the top 30% intelligibility. So people really do struggle with these devices. Okay, so what does assistive listening do to help? Well, forgive me if this is a little bit basic level, but let's just represent it graphically for a moment. Here we've got a talker and a listener with a hearing aid. We've got a fundamental sine wave representing the signal we're trying to listen to, and there's a whole lot of noise on top of that. This is a challenging environment for a listener. Now, I'm very aware that I've got something of an expert audience here, so I made sure that the marketing department got all the graphics to be absolutely correct. So this is their idea of a sound reinforcement system. Simply making it louder doesn't necessarily fix the issue. Yeah, we can get around some of the signal-to-noise ratio issues that way, but we still have all the challenges of the acoustic space in terms of reverberation, reflection, all the stuff we've been hearing about previously. So simply making it louder is not necessarily the answer. What we do with assistive listening is to cut out as much of the acoustic space as we possibly can. So we're transmitting sound directly to the user, bypassing all of the challenges that we've spent the last day and a half talking about. It does, of course, require us to minimize the acoustic path from talker to microphone, of course, and we'll look at that in just a few moments. The effect for a listener is that, let's say they're going to a public lecture or something like that, it's as if they're talking, don't worry, they're not going to kiss. It's as if they're listening right next to the person who's talking rather than sitting across the acoustic space. And we play some sound clips when we're introducing this to beginners, and I'm very aware that I've not got a beginner's audience today, but I thought it might be just interesting to play one clip for you briefly, which is a repeat. Unfortunately, it's my voice. You'll be disappointed to hear. Repeating the same phrase twice, once in noise, and once with that noise attenuated by 20 dB. Now, we think of signal-to-noise ratio in playback systems. I think the original Sony Walkman had a signal-to-noise ratio of about 40 dB, and that was deemed to be ghastly. But we've pulled this down by just 20 dB in this case, and I still find it interesting how much that 20 dB sounds like. If I can find my mouse cursor to... You know what it is? It's the remote for my presentation thing. Stops the mouse working. Bear with me just one moment. There we go. Right.
Conduction loop systems are solutions for assisted listening, providing access to high-quality internal sound for hard of hearing. These systems are a great benefit to the hard of hearing, and demand has been rapidly increasing around the world. Conduction loop systems are solutions for assisted listening, providing access to high-quality intelligible sound for the hard of hearing. These systems are a great benefit to the hard of hearing, and the demand for them is rapidly increasing around the world.
So we went from something that was really quite challenging to listen to something that was, yeah, there's some irritating background noise there, but entirely intelligible with just a 20 dB improvement. And to revisit that graph we saw earlier, this is a repeat of that survey when people were listening via an assistive listening system. You saw that curve was sort of heavily weighted around the 30, 40, 50% range, and now we've got 85% of respondents in the top 30%, and the majority of those in the 9 and 10 out of 10 rating band. So clearly, this technology is extremely effective for people who have hearing difficulties. And if we just, to highlight the point, turn those two graphs around by 90 degrees and lay them over the top of each other, as a user experience, I think that's quite telling of just how valuable this kind of technology is to users. Okay, so a little bit about hearing loop or induction loop systems themselves and how they work. You may possibly have seen this graphic before. It's I think if we earn some royalties for every time it's been published on the web, we could retire by now. Let's take you through the system components. So we've got some kind of source, and we'll look at this again in just a moment. That's connected to a loop amplifier. The amplifier drives a current around the loop itself, and at its most basic, that is simply a piece of wire that surrounds the space that we wish to cover. You may remember from school physics lessons, if you drive a current in a conductor, a magnetic field is created around that conductor. Similarly, if we put a coil into that magnetic field, a current is induced in the coil. Those of you who have coffee this morning may realize what we've just built is a transformer with a massive air gap. That coil is located within the hearing aid. In Europe, the fitment rate is typically 95%, so a little lower in North America, perhaps 75, 80%, but that is increasing, and there's more legislation on the way to dictate the fitment of those devices. The little amplifier in the hearing aid takes that signal, passes it to the loudspeaker in the hearing aid, and the user gets sound direct to the ear. So we've got a couple of those elements in detail here. This is a photo I took 2 or 3 years ago at a school in Scotland. So you can see it's a music classroom. We've got some keyboards laid out there. It's approximately a 1.5-story space, this, so it's quite a tall ceiling. Some genius has hidden the amplifier up in the roof there for ease of servicing. But wait, what's that in the middle of the roof we can see? That is the microphone. And this is something we see pretty commonly with assistive listening systems. For some reason, and we're often talking about people who are familiar with audio systems, that is seen as an appropriate place to put an omnidirectional boundary microphone with the goal of picking up clear sound. And I think the feeling is that there's perhaps some kind of voodoo or witchcraft that happens in the amplifier that somehow de-reverberates the sound. I mean, if you talk to people about it, you could walk up to somebody in the street, hand them a tape recorder and say, make a recording of your voice. Where are you going to hold the microphone? Right there. But you can have experienced audio engineers who don't get this concept, which is kind of unbelievable. Speaking of voodoo and witchcraft, this is one of our amplifiers. Rest assured, there are no things with pins being stuck in them anywhere inside that amplifier. Essentially, it's just a specialized type of loudspeaker amplifier. You could plug a speaker into the back of it. It's got speak on NL4 outputs on, and sound would come out. There are a couple of specializations. Look at one of those in just a minute, but rest assured, it's just an audio amp with some slightly different details for the kind of loop load we're dealing with. So a little bit more about the physics. I'm aware I've got a more advanced audience than usual here, so I figure I'm going to hit you with some science. Here we're looking at a section view of a loop. We're flowing a current in this loop, and we're creating a magnetic field around it. We sort of covered this just a couple of minutes ago, but a little more detail just now. We place that coil, which is in the hearing aid, into that magnetic field, and the current is induced in it. You'll notice that inside the loop, the arrows the vectors that are produced by the wire are in the same direction inside the loop. But if we take an extension of, say, this right-hand loop, keep going out, once we get outside the loop, they're in opposite polarity outside of the room. And the effect that has is that at a certain position, usually just outside the loop, so you can see our measurement point here, there's one wire, there's the other, we get to a position where the vertical component of the field, it's worth mentioning that the pickup coil in the hearing aid is sensitive only to the vertical component of the field. So at that point, the vertical component, illustrated here by the field from the red wire and the blue wire, are equal in amplitude, opposite in polarity, and we get cancellation at that point. If we map that in 3D, well, I tell a lie, in 2D, you can see we get this ring of cancellation just outside the room. But the good news is that inside the loop, which is illustrated by the black box, we've got nice smooth coverage. So hence, we have to put the wire around the space that we're covering. If we look at this in section view now, we have a listener in the room. He's going to do a kind of forwards moonwalk across the space. And anywhere he goes in the room, he's getting good coverage. But if he steps just outside the room, he can move into that null point. So we need to be aware that the magnetic field has a shape, and it's a result of the interaction between the various wires that we're using. We don't just cover whole spaces, though. We might look at local coverage systems. So this is a reception desk that's got the loop illustrated in blue, located in the modesty panel there. And that creates a field pattern, something like that. And a listener can walk up to the desk and get some assistance from this field that we're generating. It's worth mentioning you don't want to put that loop around a ticket window because your head's likely to end up right in the middle of the coil where we have this dead spot. Okay, so it's a whistle-stop tour of some typical applications. Loops really rose to popularity originally in the house of worship sector, partly because often the spaces with the most challenging acoustics that we'll encounter. But also there's a sort of inevitable sense of benevolence towards users. A lot of other applications has been more legislation-driven. Sorry, before I go on, that's either St. Paul's Cathedral or Westminster Abbey in London. I forget exactly which of the two it is. We've covered both of them, but that's one of the two. That is Westminster. Excuse my ignorance. Theatres and cinemas, another very common application for loops. This is one of the Royal Shakespeare Company theatres at Stratford in the UK again. What we're showing here is that it doesn't really matter how complicated the shape is, it's possible to cover it and control the interaction between, say, adjacent balconies. Classrooms, lecture theatres, very large application area for us. Obviously, the institutions are keen to make sure that students can hear clearly and learn effectively. Live events and that kind of environment's been a bit of a slow burner for us, but there's been a real increase in demand in this sector, particularly driven by charitable groups and that kind of thing. So we supplied some systems for the famous Glastonbury Festival in the UK just a few weeks ago. A number of other live event groups are interested in pursuing this more as well. We'll look at the different types of technology in a moment, but because the user carries their own receiver in the hearing aid, loop systems are particularly suitable for situations where the user is transient. They're just walking up to something like a reception desk or a service point, and they don't have to get any kind of receiver to use the system. Similarly, really about the only solution that can sensibly be used in a transport environment. So, for example, we have an on-train stroke tram product. We've supplied loops for the latest generation New York taxis. And we've been involved with a number of train and tram fleets already. Also, often in the transport environment, we get help points, intercoms, that kind of thing. Usually unmanned stations. Again, there's no possibility of handing out a receiver in that kind of environment. Airports are proving to be quite a good area for us. Again, very acoustically challenging spaces, places that people with hearing difficulties struggle to hear announcements and so on. Lifts, forgive the English, elevators, are a bit of an unusual application perhaps. But if you imagine a situation where a lift breaks down, the means of getting help is acoustic. And so if you're going to struggle to hear what somebody's saying, it's very important that that's covered effectively. And just to highlight that it's not just about small spaces, we provided, as far as I'm aware, the largest loop system ever assembled for the Pope's visit to the UK in 2010. This was a system big enough for 20,000 people. And the system was time-aligned to the PA because it wasn't right at the front. So there were some quite interesting engineering challenges to overcome on that project. But there's always more to do. This is the terminal shuttle at Chicago O'Hare Airport, and we saw this a couple of years ago. In an emergency, listen for announcement, use the intercom to get instructions, and if you can't hear anything, you're in trouble. Okay, so a little bit on the resurgence of loops, if you like, because it's not a new technology at all. It was really first used in the 1950s. So first, a bit about the different types of assistive listening technology. I mean, we are purely a loop manufacturer, so we have a small bias here. In a nutshell, loops are tricky to get installed in the first place. But once they're installed, the user doesn't have to wear a receiver. And that's the real benefit. Both infrared and FM systems, which are the two other primary forms of assistive listening, require a separate receiver, which then, if you like, onward transmits the sound to the hearing aid. There are two benefits to having a receiverless system. One is that for a service provider point of view, you don't have to buy those receivers, you don't have to administer them. But more to the point, from the user's point of view, you don't have to go and ask for assistance, you don't have to go and collect a receiver, you don't have to wear a device that identifies you as having a problem. And that's something that users are very heavily in favor of, i.e. not having to go and collect a receiver. And really, that user demand is what's driven the resurgence of loop technology over the last 10, 15 years, whereas previously we were seeing infrared and FM being far more popular. And much as we might not like to admit it in Europe, but what's happening in the US does have a major influence on what's happening worldwide, and there's been a real uplift in interest in this subject in the US. And again, it's end-user driven, it's the advocacy groups who have driven that. Sometimes it's not necessarily about doing the right thing from a customer service point of view. Sometimes inevitably there's a bit more of a kick involved in getting people to provide this technology, and that's where legislation comes in. Various forms of legislation apply. We've got the Equality Act in the UK. The US has the ADA. And Australia, which is a very big market for us, has the Disability Discrimination Act. Those don't normally say, you will provide a loop and it shall do X, Y, Z in terms of performance. It talks about equality of access, making sure that people who have a disability, whatever that might be, are not put at a disadvantage as a result of that disability. But as I mentioned, that doesn't tell us what we should achieve in terms of performance. That comes down to standards. And the primary document we're interested in is an IEC standard, IEC 60118 Part 4. And to my shame, the one thing I forgot to change was the date, because that's now been reissued. 2014 is the latest latest release. It doesn't actually make a very long list of demands of us in terms of performance. Essentially, there are three key criteria. One is low magnetic noise. That's interference that a user would pick up on their device. The second is making sure we have the adequate field strength, and that field strength is sufficiently consistent across the space. So we've got, if you like, democracy for users wherever they might want to sit. And finally, making sure we have a linear and, again, consistent frequency response across the space. And let's put some numbers on that. So our signal-to-noise ratio has to be, under normal circumstances, at least 32 dB. Field strength is 400 milliamps per meter. That's when we play a 1 kHz sine wave through the system. We normalize that to 0 dBL, though, so don't worry, we don't talk in milliamps per meter most of the time. That would get severely confusing. But we also have to achieve plus minus 3 dB across the whole of the listening volume, as well as that, and that's quite a tight criteria. Similarly, we have a requirement of plus minus 3 dB, referencing the level at 1K, between 100 hertz and 5 kilohertz. So it is a bandwidth-limited system. This is not a kind of hi-fi system, if you like. But the vast majority of hearing aids have a frequency response that's barely any wider than that. So it's not quite as much of a problem as you might think based on particularly that HF restriction there. Okay, so we've talked about what we're trying to achieve. Well, what gets in the way of us doing that? And I mentioned earlier quite a lot of systems don't work very well. Well, here's the quick guide to how to not mess up. First thing to talk about is equipment specification, and this was referenced in a different area in the line array discussion yesterday afternoon about how comparing products like for like can be very difficult. The default method for specifying power in these systems has been square meterage of a room. But if we consider a conventional single loop, a perimeter loop around the outside of a room, the shape of that loop has a dramatic effect on performance. So we've got two spaces here of the same square meterage, but we're two models apart in our range of amplifiers to drive those two effectively. And it's quite simply that the corridor shape space, the two side wires are much closer together, you need less power to span that distance, so you can use a smaller amplifier. The square space, which of course most spaces are much closer to being a square than they are a corridor, requires much greater power to cover that greater span. Manufacturers do have a habit of looking at the more optimistic number, shall we say. So you can get two products that both claim to cover 500 square meters, but actually have a dramatically different power capability in the real world. And that's before we start to get onto short-term peak versus continuous, peak versus RMS. One manufacturer even specs products in terms of peak-to-peak, which is a new one by me in audio full stop. So specs can be misleading, and we're best off avoiding area coverage as a means of speccing equipment. This is a slide I don't get to pull out very often because we normally go straight over people's heads, but I figure I've got an advanced audience, so why not? And apologies in advance for any loudspeaker specialists in the room because this is a bit of an approximation. What we're looking at here are two impedance curves, well, two and a half impedance curves. The darker green line is my approximation to a typical impedance curve for a two-way vented loudspeaker enclosure. We've got a couple of spikes, one slightly off the graph around the port tuning frequency, one around the crossover frequency, but nominally we're looking at a straight line, and that's what the lighter green line is, a trend line through that curve. We're seeing a nominal impedance around about 4 ohms, and even where we're seeing quite a big spike around the crossover frequency, it's not much more than a doubling of impedance there. The red line, on the other hand, is a typical loop impedance curve. Because it's just a piece of wire, and often not a very long piece of wire, the DC component, plain resistance, is often very low. We're seeing probably a little bit under 1 ohm here, but our smallest professional series amplifier will drive down to 0.2 of an ohm. So we can be looking at a very low impedance at low frequency. So you can see from this curve, the impedance up at about 5 kilohertz can be 5, 6 plus times higher than it is at low frequency. So effectively, the load is a giant low-pass filter. If we try to use a loudspeaker amp to drive this current delivery, and you remember we're listening to the current, delivers the magnetic field, will diminish as frequency goes up, and that's going to result in a terrible frequency response. So the amplifiers have to be current-driven rather than voltage-driven you'd normally have with a loudspeaker amp. That's one specialization. The other is, of course, they've got to cope with that very low impedance. So our current voltage relationship is different, and we have to make sure we take care of the thermal management associated with those very low impedances. Okay, the two big subjects we need to talk about. The first one is metal loss. This is signal loss caused by structural metalwork. We've got some typical types of construction illustrated here. That was the wrong button. Steel mesh reinforced concrete on the left. Over on the right-hand side, profiled steel deck or rib deck construction. And in the middle, raised access floor, computer floor, various names for it. Any kind of grid or sheet structure in the same orientation as the loop and adjacent to the loop causes signal losses. And we're talking both about the strength of the signal, but also the frequency response. Both of those effects can also vary across a space. So one of the things you sometimes hear people saying is, oh, there's a dead spot in the middle. Well, let's look at what that looks like in just a moment. So here we've got a predicted versus measured performance graph here. And this is for a pretty small room. This is, just under 6 by just over 3.5 meters. Small perimeter loop. We're driving, I hate that none of these numbers are rounded nicely. It really annoys me. Let's call that 3 amps of current. We're predicting at that point we should be at plus 3.5 dB. We're aiming for 0. We've got plenty of headroom on tap, and our frequency response should be linear. But in practice, we've gone to measure this on site, and we found that at 1 kilohertz, where we measure field strength, we're 5.5 dB down, and we've got a pretty nasty frequency response. What can we do about that? Well, All decent amplifiers have a loop amplifiers have a feature called metal loss compensation. Some call it tone. Some just call it HF. There are various captions for it, but essentially it's a piece of EQ, normally, which is a pivoting filter, rather like the kind of thing you get on an old transistor radio, that boosts HF, cuts LF, pivoting around 1 kHz. So we turn that up. The output of the amplifier then goes from being linear to being a positive slope. And once we combine that with the loss effect in the room, we end up back at a linear frequency response situation. And we'll hopefully demonstrate that a little bit later with the demo kit we have just over there. So wind in some metal loss compensation, and we're back to a linear frequency response. And then it's just a case of adding some more power to boost that curve up to where it ought to be. So we're at 3 amps at the moment. We're pretty much 6 dB down. So if we double the current to about 6 amps, we'll be back where we want to be. Let's look at a slightly bigger room. So this space, 10 by 10, this time the loop's in the suspended ceiling, although that doesn't make a huge difference. This time, we're taking it a bit more seriously in the first place. We're driving 6.5 amps to start with. The model suggests that we should see a linear frequency response, and we should be at plus 2 dB, so we've got a little bit of headroom on tap. But it hasn't quite worked out that way, as you can see, and we are a massive 22 dB down on our 0 dB target. And because we should be at plus 2, we've actually lost 24 dB in this room. Also got a particularly unpleasant frequency slope. It's worth mentioning, this is a measurement taken in the middle of the room, whereas that one is a measurement taken near the edge. So at this point, we've got nothing like such a bad result. We could set about correcting one or the other of those two curves, but we're still going to see that massive variation at 1 kHz of just under 16 dB, and we've got to be within 6, the plus minus 3 that we're aiming for. So there's nothing we can do to bolt extra equipment onto this loop that's going to fix the problem. So what we do instead is what we call a multi-loop system. So the bigger the loop is, the worse the problem will be. So we get around that by using multiple smaller loops. So here we've got 3 loops. These are probably around about 3 meters in the narrow dimension each. And above each of those loops, we'll get good performance. We're going to get nulls in between. We get around that problem by installing a second set of loops that overlap the first, and they sort of each help each other out. We drive those each with a separate amplifier channel, introduce a 90-degree phase shift between those two signals, and then they play nicely. So we go from a situation where our perimeter loop has got a big hole in the middle, as we saw on those graphs a moment ago, to a situation where that loss control multi-loop system is compensating for that metal loss and controlling it. Okay, second big subject to consider is that of overspill. Here we've got a perimeter loop. We've already seen a graphic a bit like this a number of times now, in the middle of 3 meeting rooms. You can see that our signal outside of the room that we don't particularly want is now washing out the spaces to either side. So if we had 3 adjacent meetings, this would be quite a problem. Look at this in numeric terms. We're typically saying that a perimeter loop will spill 1 to 2 times its width in the horizontal plane and 2 to 3 times vertically. On the other hand, if we look at a low spill system, as we call it, and you may have guessed there's going to be a solution to this problem, we can cut that down to a very small distance horizontally, but there is still a little bit more of a restriction vertically, which we'll just look at in a moment. So the way we tackle this is to play with the loop sizes, essentially, and by carefully dimensioning those loops, we can achieve complete cancellation outside of the room horizontally. But the same problem exists that we still have these dead spots. So we put a second set of loops in, as before, overlapping the first set to fill in the blanks. We go from a situation where we have a perimeter loop that's spilling significantly out of the room to a low spill system that controls that very accurately. It's worth mentioning as well, this particular system is installed right up to the walls. Normally, we'd leave a little bit of a gap, so the control is a little tighter than illustrated there. If we look at the vertical situation, again, we saw a plot a bit like this where we had our moonwalking man earlier, this time overlaid on 3 stories of a building. You can see we've got significant washout of the floors above and below. If we look at a low spill equivalent, we've cut that down dramatically. It's worth noting, though, if we go up one level, we've pretty much cut it off. If we come down, we still have quite a bit of field present there. So it's not, you know, a universal solution. We still have to be a little careful when we're looking at vertically adjacent spaces. So just a word of warning, even with a low spill design, we still have to take into consideration adjacent spaces. There's normally a way around it. We have a number of get out of jail free cards on this subject, but just bear in mind you can't install low spill with impunity. Okay, final subject to discuss. Then it's on to doing a little bit of a demo. How do we test and measure systems? Now, one of the joys of loops is that they are invisible, in effect. You know, the system can be installed and working and nobody knows anything about it. But the number of customers we come to us and say, well, there are some lights flashing on the amplifier. It must have been working, right? Never ceases to amaze us. And there are a number of devices available which can help to sort of demystify what's going on with this, again, sort of voodoo-based system that nobody really knows much about. So historically, we've had integrated meters, the proprietary meters. These are your sort of entry-level tools. This is our product called the Field Strength Meter, or FSM. It's got an LED bar graph on it, and you can use it to measure the three things that the standard asks for: magnetic background noise, the strength of the signal that the system itself is delivering, and the frequency response. And in the case of this device, we measure frequency response by taking three third octave bands, one at 1K, one at 100 Hz, one at 5K, and if the amplitude in each of those is even, we know we've got nominally a flat frequency response. You may have gathered from some of those graphs we were looking at earlier that we don't usually have weird-shaped frequency curves. It's normally a straight line. Either because of an impedance issue we looked at earlier, if you've got a low-quality amplifier, or a metal loss issue, as we saw on those graphs. So this is the entry-level tool. We then have a more advanced tool. Now, this is designed to replace the measurement microphone on an audio analyzer. Primarily, we're talking about a Neutrik NTI minimalizer. And if you have the Minilink equipped version, that has the software built in for loop optimization. Some of the parameters and were changed to make it measure loops the way they're supposed to be measured. So this was the consultant level professional tool, if you like, for people who are really serious about measuring loops. At this point, you can do proper third octave analysis, greater accuracy of readings. The downside of this tool, of course, is that it's not exactly free with cornflakes. Very expensive thing to buy. If you've already got one because you're doing acoustic measurements, then it makes perfect sense to add that upgrade in the form of the calibrated loop receiver. But as a standalone package, very expensive thing to buy. And this leads us on to a mixture of a demo and a shameless plug, in that we're going to be having a look at our new tool, which is called LoopWorks Measure. And so we're going to just quickly show this to you, but also illustrate a few of the things that we've been talking about while we do it. Okay, just give me a moment while I transfer a few things over. Are we muted here, Danny? So as you probably gather from that illustration, the new tool is going to be iOS-based. So I get to try out my new toy, which is the AV adapter for the phone. On a really good day, this will work beautifully. It's telling me I need to plug my receiver in. Because of the way the phone works, you often have to plug it in and out a few times. Okay, so we're up and running there. I just need to bring the computer over a second. Okay, so what we've got here, effectively just using the laptop as a glorified signal generator. We're running into this small loop amplifier just here. This is the kind of device you might use on a reception desk or something like that. And that's driving this miniature loop. It's just a small travel size version of what you might use in something like a reception desk. A typical reception desk loop is more like that kind of size. Okay. So I'm just going to pop some 1 kHz sine wave into the system a moment. First thing to do, I think, is to demonstrate background noise measurement. So here you can see we're aiming for minus 32, and we're comfortably below that, so reasonably quiet space magnetically. Go into field strength measurement mode now. Get that 1K sine wave playing. If I lift the receiver over the top of the loop here, you'll see that we've got to spoof this a little bit because we've got to imagine a listening height here. But if I wind this in, we get to a situation where we're hitting our 0 dB target. So we measure field strength that way. The more interesting part, I think, is going to be to look at frequency response. So we've got third octave frequency response measurement here. Each square represents 1 dB. So out away from the loop, you can see we've got a whole load of noise. But if we hover this over this point here, we get to a nice flat line. We demonstrate what that metal loss compensation filter we were talking about earlier does. If I turn that up now, you see we get an LF cut and HF boost. The other thing I think would be interesting to do is have a look at what happens when we introduce some metalwork into the vicinity of all these systems. So here we've got a piece of calibrated aluminium. Drop that one over the top. Has a pretty significant effect on system performance. We can actually do the same thing. We go back to field strength view. Drop that in so that we're listening to peak noise now, so the level's a little bit lower. But you can see we're losing quite a good chunk of level just there. Okay. It's worth noting that obviously we've just covered that up. That's possibly a bit of an unfair test to do, but if we just repeat that by putting the metal underneath the loop, it's not much better than it was before. So proximity is the issue, not necessarily shielding. What we can do now, though, is demonstrate the use of that metal loss compensation filter. So if I turn that one up, probably to somewhere around about there, a little bit more, we can once again flatten that curve out and we go back to a pass condition. So the frequency slope the metal is introducing can be compensated for by playing with the output of the amplifier. How are we doing for time? Not bad. Okay, I think the final thing to do, at the risk of stating the obvious, I mean, your audio people, you know what that curve's going to look like, but I thought it might be interesting just to play a short passage of music so you can hear that. Oh, apparently that's, I've got an appointment. So A, you can hear what one of these things sounds like, but B, also hear what effect that metalwork has on it. And it's always a nerve-wracking moment, this, when you're choosing what to play for demonstration purposes. So I thought it was only right and reasonable that I paid homage to our host country. And the mouse did hover momentarily over Bryan Adams, I'm not going to lie, but not for very long. And I discovered that actually in my little collection of things I use for audio purposes, I had a track that was particularly nicely recorded by Nelly Furtado, of all people. So I thought I'd just give that a quick play, and you can have a listen to see what this thing sounds like. So, nice clear transmission.
Orlando.
Not a huge amount of HF as you would expect.
Everything
but
is not as it's sold.
We're not losing anything very much now.
But the more I grow.
We can sell the metal sheet.
The less I know.
I think we've had a pretty profound effect on intelligibility just there.
Many lives.
Repeat that underneath.
Oh, I'm not old. And the more I see,
it's not quite as severe, but still pretty bad.
The fewer the seeds, the more I.
So, don't worry, that's all the music for now. Yeah, I thought it was worth just giving you a little demo so you could see what these things sound like and also hear for yourself what a profound effect metal can have on system performance. I think that just leads me to ask if there are any questions at all from the floor, and to thank you for your attention. Oh, wow, the hands are off already. Wow. Okay, do you get a microphone to one of you gentlemen?
Yes. Testing 1, 2. Testing 1, 2. Yes, I'm. In our system, we have trouble from sitting to standing,
mm-hmm.
and we haven't been able to really come up with a good solution for that.
Okay. There quite often can be a fair degree of variation with height. So it depends on the system type in use. If it's a perimeter loop, you generally get less variation with height. I mean, we should only be talking in theory about a handful of dB. I mean, many variables influence it, but it can be as low as a couple of dB. You might, with a particularly densely packed array system, say one which had to compensate for very high metal losses, or which had a particularly tight spill control criteria, you might see a bit more than that. You might see 5-6 dB possibly. If you're seeing a lot more than that, I'd suggest there's something rather more complex going on. Yeah, it can be tricky to get the full range of heights from, say, a seated user to a tall standing adult covered. You usually can't get that within the plus minus 3 in most situations. So we prioritize the primary usage mode. But you certainly shouldn't be seeing much more than, you know, even in those two extremes with a really densely packed array, it should be under 10 dB, certainly.
In our system, it goes dead.
Right, okay, so this is from seated to standing.
Yeah, seating is fine. When you get to a standing position, cuts out.
Right, interesting. There could be a number of things going on there. One possibility is to do with coil orientation. So the coil is supposed to be vertical. Are you measuring with a test device of some description?
No, just from practical experience.
Right, with a hearing aid user
yes.
reporting this?
Yes.
Okay, there was an issue for a short while that we mentioned IEC 60118 Part 4. Part 1 was the bit relating to the hearing aids. And for a while, that said, definitely install the coils horizontally. So that caused a bit of difficulty. So sometimes coil orientation in the hearing aid can cause a problem like that if you happen to be at a point where there's a big transition with height. Mm-hmm. So that's one possibility. Obviously, without seeing the system, it's hard to say for sure. But you certainly shouldn't have that kind of problem. It's not an inherent feature of the technology.
Thank you.
All right.
So is that app available now?
It will be very shortly. I believe the launch date is within a month. That's the goal. So the hope is that we're pricing it pretty aggressively on the basis that, A, it's a really neat toy and you know, people ought to want it. But also, there's a kind of implied professionalism with it, if you like. If somebody uses this tool and thinks that's really neat, it works well, and it's clever, then they're hopefully going to think that the rest of what we sell is similarly advanced. That's the goal. But yeah, that should be out hopefully within a month. I don't know specifically in North America. In the UK, the receiver, this little probe thing that we've got plugged in the bottom here, that's £150, so that's about £300. The app itself is free, but obviously doesn't do anything without the receiver. There is going to be an ongoing sort of maintenance charge to go with that. In the UK, that's looking at being around about £60, so £120 a year. And that buys you ongoing support. This does a number of other things, including it has like a test wizard built in, and you can save results to a database on our server and then go to the web version of this and print off a certificate. At the moment, you fill in a paper certificate as you go. This does it electronically. So the subscription, A, unlocks ongoing support, but also gives you those more advanced features. But compared with, I mean, that is about half the price of that integrated meter we looked at a minute ago. So we're pricing it pretty aggressively.